So I think we're going to just start in chapter 8. Obviously, some of this we're dealing with in more detail, some of it less. A 48-chapter book we're not going to cover in detail in 45-minute classes. But we can overview some things, and we will look at this section in 8 to 11 a little more carefully than some things. So you remember where Ezekiel was, right? Where was Ezekiel? In
Babylon,
already in captivity, but the Jerusalem has not fallen yet. And in verse 1 of chapter 8, the elders of Judah that are in captivity have come to Ezekiel, and they're sitting in front of him. Now, I'm not sure how this worked, but there was this man in verse 2, and look at his appearance of fire, brightness, glowing metal. And look at verse 3, he stretched out the form of a hand and caught me by a lock of my head. That would not be an easy thing to do with my head, but some of you, that would be a little easier. And the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem. Now, I don't know, you know, Paul said in 2 Corinthians 12 that he was caught up to the third heaven, but he didn't know if it was in the body or out of the body. I don't really know if Ezekiel was in the body or out of the body when he was caught up by the hair of his head and taken over to Jerusalem. But what happens is, for these next four chapters, he's going to be in Jerusalem, kind of reporting what he sees. Some of the other classes have said this still happens. I haven't had a TV in years, so I don't know what's on TV. But they used to do these nature programs where somebody would be filming wildlife. They'd be talking kind of quietly because you don't want to disturb the wildlife and the natural habitat. Does that still kind of happen?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm envisioning here. You know, the Spirit has taken Ezekiel off, and, you know, he's going to be reporting things in the temple in Jerusalem, but nobody seems to see him. You know, he seems to kind of be invisible, and he's able to just kind of tell us the stuff that's going on there. And it's not a pretty picture. Now, you know what's special about the temple in Jerusalem. What was special about it?
God dwelled there.
God dwelled there. That's exactly right. And, you know, that's a really impressive thing in and of itself. God dwelling among his people. So look at what he sees. Verse 5. Son of man, raise your eyes now toward the north. So I raised my eyes toward the north, and behold, to the north of the altar gate was this idol of jealousy at the entrance. Now, to understand that, we need to understand this. What was the relationship that God had to his people? What family relationship did God have to his people?
Abraham, Isaac, Jacob.
All right, father, son, but he also had another relationship. What other kind of family relationship did he have to his people?
Husband,
wife. Are we the bride of Christ? Kind of like we're married to him. Israel was married to God, so they were like his wife. None of you campers, I don't think, are married, right? You're a little young for that, maybe. But anybody here think you ever will get married? Yeah, okay, wow. You've got a lot of guys that are going to have to find enough victims for all of you. But, you know, so I want you to imagine that you're married. And this is bad, but you'll need to understand this to relate to this. So your wife has an affair. And not only that, but she gets a great big portrait of her lover boy and hangs in your bedroom. How are you going to feel? Yeah! That's probably not strong enough, right? You going to put up with that? She not only had the affair, but she wants to look at him every night before she goes to sleep? Whoa! What are they doing in the temple in God's house? They've got this idol of jealousy. Jealousy because God's jealous. They put this statue of this other husband, this other man, right there in the place where they live with God. Wow. Can you imagine how God felt about that? And notice verse 6. He said to me, Son of man, do you see what they're doing? The great abominations which the house of Israel are committing here, so that I would be far from my sanctuary. In other words, they're trying to drive me out. Would you just stay in that bedroom with that big portrait of that, lover of your wife? He said, I'm going to leave. He says, but you will see still greater abominations. By the way, abominations is one of the key words in Ezekiel. It's used a lot more in Ezekiel than any other book in the Bible. He says, it's going to get worse. You thought you saw something bad? You haven't seen anything yet. And so in verse 7, takes us to another part, where in verse 10, they have carved all sorts of animal figures on the cave walls, and they're offering incense to those animal figures, including in verse 11, Jazaniah, the son of Shaphan. You probably don't know who Shaphan was, but he's an important guy in the Old Testament. He was involved in Josiah's reformation. He had three sons who were important guys in Jeremiah and Ezekiel that were great, and a grandson who was really good, Gedaliah, who was the governor that Babylon appointed later on. This Jazaniah is the black sheep. He's the bad guy out of this good family. And he's involved with these 70 elders who are worshiping these animal figures on the cave wall. It's pretty shocking to see that. Obviously, they don't have much faith in God. You know, look at verse 12. Son of man, do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are committing in the dark? Each man in the room of his carved images, for they say the Lord does not see us, for the Lord has forsaken the land. They think I can't see them. What does he keep asking Ezekiel? Son of man, do you
see?
Even Ezekiel can see it, and they think God can't? You ever felt that way? You ever tried to hide something bad you did from your parents? You know, this is kind of embarrassing, but I told it in another class. Maybe it's an effective illustration. It just kind of popped in my head. You know, you do some dumb things with your kids. Hopefully you did too. I was probably 9, I don't know, and 10. It was the winter, and one of my neighbor kids from school, he missed school, and so back in that day, they sent the homework home with a neighbor to take to him. That's what they did with me. They sent me with the homework to carry down to my neighbor's house. Well, I had a bright idea. You know, as a little kid, you want adventure. There was a big puddle, like in front of our mailbox, that had iced over. And I thought it'd be fun to ride my bicycle and kind of slide it over that puddle or whatever. So I talked my mom into letting me take my bicycle, the two doors down, to my neighbor's house to give him the homework. And then on the way back, I hit that iced over puddle, and of course, I went completely flat down, crashed, and it kind of hurt. Like, I thought I kind of injured myself some, but I didn't think it was too bad. I wasn't sure. So, of course, I'm trying to be all cool, and I'm not going to tell anybody what I've done. You know how that is. You're embarrassed about all that. So I go in, and I told Mom I wanted to take a shower. Well, I just really wanted to inspect myself and see how bad off I was, you know. And that's when she revealed she'd been watching me through the picture window. Why didn't I think of that? I have no idea. You know, so hiding it from her didn't work at all. She knew exactly what had happened. You know, you ever done that? You know, thought you were hiding it, and you weren't? Do we ever try to do that with our sins? You ever tried to hide them from other Christians and kind of felt like maybe God didn't know? You ever been too embarrassed to tell God something you did? Did you think if you didn't tell him, maybe he wouldn't find out? You know, it's like, how do we think God doesn't see? They thought he didn't see it. Wow. They are blind themselves to imagine that. And he says Ezekiel is going to get worse, verse 13. He brings him in verse 14 to the entrance of the gates of the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and the women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. I don't know if any of you know about Tammuz or not, but Tammuz was the god that died every summer, and that brought on the drought and the heat of summer, and then he came back to life in the late fall when the rain started coming back. And so they would mourn over Tammuz' death when the dry spell hit until he came back to life and the rain came back. What do you think about that kind of mythology? You know, Taylor.
Was he a Babylonian god?
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, I think he was more just a general ancient Near Eastern god. I don't think he was confined to Babylon. But, yeah, I mean, you know, that's rank paganism among the people of God. You know, what in the world are they doing mourning Tammuz's death? And look at verse 15 again. He said to me, do you see this, Son of Man? Yet you will see greater abominations than these. So think about it. You know the one thing in this passage that absolutely couldn't see anything? All these idols. They had eyes, but they couldn't see. They thought God couldn't see. God can see. Ezekiel can see. It's the things they're worshiping they can't even see. Isn't that ironic? And then he says it gets worse. So verse 16, he brings me into the inner court of the Lord's house, which means he's as close to the presence of God as he gets in this tour. And behold, you know, when you use the word behold in the Bible, a lot of times it's like, you know, would you get a look at this? You know, wow. Can you imagine this? Kind of like a strong word. So he said, and behold, at the entrance to the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, about 25 men with their back to the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, they were prostrating themselves eastward toward the sun. They're worshiping the sun. Now, anybody remember, one class did and one class didn't, what direction did the temple face?
East.
What direction does the sun come up?
East.
They are bowing down. Now, they're right in front of the presence of God, bowing down to the sun. So what are they showing the Lord? Yeah, their hind end. You know, they got to stick that in the Lord's face. Isn't that disrespectful? It's just so disgusting. Wow, can you imagine these are God's people doing these things? They've certainly turned their back on God. It's not just that. Verse 17, he said to me, do you see this, Son of Man? Is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they've committed here, that they filled the land with violence and provoked me repeatedly? It's not surprising that false worship leads to false morality. They're not only worshiping wrong, there are violent and terrible things are going on among them. And they put the twig to their nose. Nobody knows for sure what that means. It may be they did something kind of rude toward the Lord as they stuck their posterior in his face. He says, therefore I indeed will deal in wrath. My eye will have no pity, nor will I spare. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, yet I will not listen to them. They haven't listened to the Lord. Why would he listen to their cries for mercy? So Ezekiel, who's in captivity, is brought back to Jerusalem, and he sees all the horrible stuff going on. Now, think about what the people in captivity at that point were hoping for. What were they hoping to be able to do? Come back to Jerusalem. What is this showing you?
Things are going on really bad in Jerusalem. God's not about to spare Jerusalem. You don't want to come back there. The future of Israel is not with Jerusalem right now, that's for sure. And that's what Ezekiel's seeing, that he's going to, at the end of chapter 11, he's going to report it all to these elders. This is what I saw. Comments or questions about chapter 8? Noah.
Kind of reminds me of the beginning of 1 Samuel when the ark is taken to Babylonian temples, or sorry, Philistine temples, and the other gods, you know, end up falling down over and over and over again, and then people get sick and stuff, but it just made me think of, you know, they're bringing idols into God's temple, and the difference is God is going to let his people choose, and so if they don't want him in the temple, he's going to leave, whereas when he's put into a position where he can make the other nations pay for their actions, I'm going to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Good thought. Other comments? Okay, chapter 9. God calls for the executioner. He gets six of them with destroying weapons in their hand, and they're going to come and execute his wrath on Jerusalem. Now, there's also a guy dressed in linen with a little writing case and a pen. And what he does is, he tells the guy with the writing case in verse 4, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being committed in its midst. So, you've got a guy going around marking the foreheads of all the righteous people. That probably won't be a big job. But he does mark them. And then, verse 5, he tells these six executioners, go through the city after him and strike. Do not let your eye have pity and do not spare. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, and women, but do not touch any man on whom is the mark, and you shall start from my sanctuary. So who's supposed to be executed?
Everyone without the mark.
Yeah, including...
men, women, children.
Yeah. People you would think God would have spared. It's total execution except for those with the mark. Can you think of any times in history where God spared the righteous and killed the wicked? I understand. It happens to me all the time, Noah. The firstborn of the Israelites were spared when the firstborn of the Egyptians weren't, Caleb?
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, good one. What else, Paul?
This was Israelite history or just world history?
History.
Noah's flood.
Noah's flood? Is that what you were thinking of?
No, I was thinking of Revelation where they have...
Yeah, exactly. Good. This passage is very parallel to Revelation 7. Exactly. Yes.
Abraham and Isaac.
Yes. Okay. So it's kind of normal for God to spare the righteous and kill the wicked. And he starts with the temple. You can understand why he started with the temple. That's where the abominations were headquartered. And he doesn't exempt anybody. That's what's happening. His eye will not pity or spare, verse 10, I will bring their conduct upon their heads. Now, here's another thing going on. I'm just going to summarize. But through these chapters, you've got the Lord leaving. So, the Lord dwelt between the cherubim and the Holy of Holies. But you see him leaving the Holy of Holies and moving out to the threshold of the temple. Now, you remember in chapter 1, God's chariot-like thing, right? With the four living creatures with the four heads and the wheels within the wheels and all that. So it get revved, you get the motor revved up on it, we hear that, the wings flapping and one thing and another. And God ends up moving outside of the temple, moving out of Jerusalem, over to the mountains east of Jerusalem, and then on off. God leaves the house. But if your wife had the portrait of that lover of hers in the bedroom, you'd probably leave the house too. You know, you see why you left. It's not God's house anymore. You're not going to stay there. Not with all this garbage going on. Of course, if God's not there anymore, what's going to keep it from being destroyed? Nothing. And so that's what's going to happen. Comments and questions. This is really through chapter 10. Taylor.
Would it have been specifically important that the judgment started at the temple? I mean, is that the place like when people would go to seek mercy, they'd go to the altar and like grab the horns of the altar? So in a way it's showing that you can't do that here.
Yeah, there's probably several symbolic elements. I've seen it more the idea that that's where the abominations were so strong, and so it's a good place to start. But you're right also, it eliminates the mercy that you get from the sacrifices and from the horns of the altar and so forth. Good thought. Other comments? Yeah.
Were the executioners like human or like angels?
Symbolic, let's say. I don't assume that literally there was a guy who went around and marked their foreheads, or that literally there were six executioners. I think the executioners are the Babylonian army. So this is typical of visions. There are visions that symbolize the reality. Revelation 7. You have the seal of God put on the foreheads of the 144,000 righteous. But tell me, can you tell who's a Christian and who's not by looking at their forehead? I don't really think Christian foreheads look any different than non-Christian foreheads, do they? They all have pretty much the same looking forehead, one way or the other. You know, so I don't think it's literal. I think it's symbolic. But that the things really happen, but we're just seeing a picture, a kind of a fantasized picture of it. That's true a lot of times in this apocalyptic literature, which we haven't spoken about and I won't. But you'll see a lot of this visionary, almost sci-fi visionary stuff in like Ezekiel, Daniel, Zechariah, and Revelation especially. And they're all kind of that genre of literature that we call apocalyptic, but it's kind of like that really graphic, vivid stuff. I think it's cool because you can really see it. But don't assume that it's literally executed in exactly that way. Other questions or comments? Okay, look at chapter 11 then. The Spirit brought him to the gate of east gate of the Lord's house, and he saw these 25 men. And he says in verse 2, Son of Man, these are the men who devise iniquity and give evil advice in the city. Let's see, where do I go to? Okay, I'm good. Who say, is not the time near to build houses? Now, when would you decide to build a house in a place?
When you're going to live there?
Yeah. If you're going to stay 2 weeks in a place, would you build a house there for the 2 week stay? Probably not. Maybe not even for a 2 month stay, right? Maybe not even for a 2 year stay. You're probably going to settle down. They say, might as well build houses. It's time to build houses, guys. They are implying that Jerusalem is
going
to be there for a long time. Nothing's going to happen to us. In fact, they say in the end of verse 3, this city is the pot and we are the flesh. That's an interesting illustration of theirs. They are seeing themselves as the choicest morsels of meat. They're the good stew meat and they're in the pot, the iron pot of Jerusalem that's protecting them. Nobody can get to these morsels of meat that they are as long as they got the pot around them, as long as they're in Jerusalem. So everything's going to be fine. We don't have anything to worry about. Now, I'd be worried about I'd get cooked in the pot, yeah. But they're not thinking about it that way. So, you know, it all depends on how you're thinking of the figure. But the Lord says, verse 5, House of Israel, I know your thoughts. I know what you're thinking. And it's not going to happen that way. In the end of verse 7, he says, it's the people you've killed that are the flesh in the pot, and I'm going to bring you out of the pot and kill you. The pot's not going to protect you. So much for them being, the choice flesh in the pot. That's not going to do any good. It is so common, though, for wicked people and us sometimes, when we're under God's judgment, to try to convince ourselves that there's no danger and that everything's okay. We try to clutch on to false hope. You know, we're the meat in the pot. Everything's good, we're in the pot. You know, we come up with illustrations like that to make us feel like everything's going to be okay. And that's a false confidence. You know, probably you don't know this phrase. Do you know the phrase whistling past the graveyard? Some of you know that? It's kind of the idea of like, I'm not scared. I can go past the graveyard, but you're whistling and that kind of gives you away. You're trying not to hear any spooky sounds or whatever and act like you're okay. They would keep bolstering each other's self-confidence and hopeful anticipations by all these phrases and things trying to make themselves believe everything's going to be okay. They probably are doing that a little too much, and it shows you they're a little more worried than what they're letting on like. But the Lord is obviously going to judge them and destroy them. Any questions or comments through the first half of chapter 11? Ben?
I just want to point out it started in chapter 6, but you'll see the phrase, then you will know that I'm the Lord, and they will know that I'm the Lord. And I just like to point that out because he uses it, I think, over 30 times in this book.
Way more,
like
yeah. Yeah, he uses it.
And I like to see how many times that's said.
Good point. Yes. So many of the things he's doing is showing the people who he really is. Glad you made that point, Ben. That's exactly right. Very, very important phrase in Ezekiel. Other thoughts? Okay, so look at verse 14. Yes. CJ?
I just think this is a good lesson for us not to get too comfortable as Christians and say, oh, well, I'm a Christian, God doesn't care what I do because I'm a Christian. Well, these people are God's people, and the Lord still judges them.
Yeah, amen. You're exactly right. We've got to not be complacent. Other thoughts? Okay. So look at verse 14. Then the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, your brothers, your relatives, your fellow exiles, and the whole house of Israel, all of them are those to whom the inhabitants of Jerusalem have said, go far from the Lord. This land has been given us as a possession. Now, Ezekiel speaking to the people who've been exiled. They've been taken away into Babylon. But their fellow countrymen who are back in Jerusalem are doing what? You have to read that a couple times. What are they doing?
They're like saying that we're the chosen ones.
We are the chosen ones, therefore, what were they doing? You have to kind of read it. Say it again.
Pushing them out.
Pushing them out. Well, they're already out. Take another step. What are they doing?
Pushing the Lord out.
Do what?
Pushing the Lord away.
Well, they're doing that. What are they? But what are they doing against these people who've left? Can you tell?
Not letting them come back.
They're saying that it's their land and no one else's land.
In other words, these guys have left their property behind, obviously, when they went into exile. And these people staying in Jerusalem are saying, oh, well, they must be being judged by God. It's our property now. And they're not here to contest it. They're not going to countersue because they're not there. This land was your land. This land is our land. Isn't that bad to be double-crossed by your own countrymen when you're taken into exile? They just took over. They took the opportunity. He said, that's what's going on back in Jerusalem. They've all, you know, horned in on your property, and they're all there and thinking it's theirs now. That's depressing. But obviously, the people who sent into exile, that's a dead end. They're not coming back. God's judging them. That's the way they look at it. But that's not true. Verse 16, the Lord says, though I had removed them far away among the nations, and though I had scattered them among the countries, yet I was a sanctuary for them for a little while in the countries where they had gone. I will be a sanctuary for these exiles. God is not confined to Jerusalem, remember? God's mobile. God will be a sanctuary for the people in Babylon. And then he'll gather them, verse 17, and assemble them from where they've been scattered and give them the land. Now, so God's going to bring them back. But really, he doesn't just mean he's going to bring them back from captivity like under Joshua and Zerubbabel when they came back to the literal city of Jerusalem. Because go on in verse 18, when they come there, they will remove all its detestable things and all its abominations from it. And I will give them one heart and put a new spirit within them. And I will take the heart of stone out of their flesh and give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them, then they will be my people and I shall be their God. So God is going to transform these people. They're going to get rid of their detestable things. And God is going to do what he says he's going to do in verse 19. Now, only probably the oldest people here, and maybe not them because there's nobody here nearly as old as me, will know who Christian Barnard was. Anybody here know who Christian Barnard was? Taylor does. Good for you, Taylor. There's not many, but when I was growing up, when I was probably 11, 12, something like that, 13, Dr. Christian Barnard was a name every American knew. Probably as big a news for us nearly as landing on the moon was what Dr. Christian Barnard was doing. You know what he was doing? The first heart transplants. That was huge. Man, he was taking hearts out of other people and putting them in you know, somebody to cure their heart. I mean, like, that happens a lot today. But the first ones were in the late 60s. He was a South African doctor. We knew the names of the people he transplanted. Those first few, that most of them didn't survive long at first. It took a while before they started surviving longer and longer. But, I mean, that was household news. I bet you 90% of Americans knew exactly who Christian Barnard was in the late 60s. God's going to do that. He's a heart surgeon. He can do heart transplants. And so what kind of heart is he going to take out of him, does he say?
Heart of stone.
Now, what's the characteristic of stone?
Hard.
Hard. He's going to take those hard, petrified hearts out of them and give them what kind of a heart?
Heart of flesh.
And what's the characteristic of flesh?
Soft,
tender, moldable, pliable,
alive.
Sensitive, something God can work with, alive. God's going to be the heart surgeon that's going to radically change them because, you know, have you ever tried to just kind of like say, I'm never going to do wrong again. Even though by your willpower, I'm not going to do that anymore. How well has that worked for you? Not so well. Because here's the problem. If you want to do wrong, you know what you're going to do? Wrong. Even if you decide I'm not going to. Well, it takes a change of heart. You can't just, you know, I'm just going to not do this. There's more to it than that. In fact, what does the New Testament call this heart surgery? It's just a whole different figure. What does the New Testament say we need? Repentance. There's a word for what God does. It's a new birth. Being born again. That's the same thing he's talking about here. Now look at the next verse. Verse 21. But as for those whose hearts go after their detestable things and abominations, I will bring their conduct down on their heads, declares the Lord God. So is God going to force a heart surgery on anybody who's rebellious and doesn't want it? No. So we need the Lord. And we need a heart transplant. We don't just need to patch up the old one. We need a whole new one. And God's the only one that can give it to us. But God only gives it to us if we want it, if we're willing for it. So you don't think you can just be transformed by your own determination. But he won't do it unless you're willing and cooperative in the process. So that's saying this, what he's promising, goes way beyond the return from captivity. He's promising the things that are going to happen in the Messiah. This is a really cool passage. Thoughts and comments? So then he brings Ezekiel back. And Ezekiel tells them everything that had happened to him. That's chapter 11. Some of this stuff we're going to treat pretty lightly. We'll just kind of talk through the general idea of it. Because obviously 48 chapters we don't have time to go through in much detail. But in chapter 12, the first part of it, Ezekiel's acting out things again. He's acting out being a refugee. What's your picture of a refugee? Can you visualize one? Yeah, a little rough around the edges. What's their mode of transportation?
Walking.
What have they got with them usually?
All their stuff.
And kind of like what?
A backpack or bag.
Yeah, kind of like a sheet behind their back. They're trudging along. That's kind of what I see. Ezekiel gets his stuff together, digs a hole in the wall, and goes out as a refugee. Of course, he'd done that already once when he was exiled. So he's picturing what's going to happen in Jerusalem. The rest of them are going to be refugees also. So that's the first half of chapter 12. Then chapter 12, verse 18, Son of man, eat your bread with trembling and drink your water with quivering and anxiety. Now, have you ever seen one of these old guys, maybe he's got Parkinson's or whatever, he's a little shaky with a hand, try to eat? How does that work?
Hard.
That's hard, and what happens? Yeah, and gets all over him. And, you know, you feel bad for them. You know, here the point is, it's going to be so, such a crisis. The Babylonians being there, they'll be so scared. What little food they've got, they're going to be trembling as they eat it. So Ezekiel's acting that out. You know, can you imagine the attention Ezekiel drew by acting out all this stuff. You know, did you get a load of what Ezekiel's doing now? You know, you could imagine that as something that probably happened and all that. And then the end of chapter 12, the people were saying, the days are long and every vision fails. We don't have to worry about these prophecies. They never come true anyway. And the visions for many days in the future, it won't happen anytime soon. You know, all these prophecies that that Ezekiel's making, they're not going to happen, or if they do happen, it won't be in our lifetime. It's not a very smart idea to say those things. You know what God says? They're not going to say that anymore. You know how he's going to make them not say that anymore? He's going to do what he said, and that'll do it. It's like, you know, challenging God, almost taunting God. You don't want to taunt a God who's tougher than you are. You know, that's not very smart. Yeah, I don't think you can beat me up. Well, don't do it to a violent guy who's stronger than you are. You know, he'll do it. He'll make an example out of you. That's what the Lord said. You're not going to use that proverb anymore. You know, so it's just that arrogance is so foolish when it comes to the Lord. Chapter 13, prophesy against the false prophet. Now, the false prophets were a big thing in the Old Testament, and particularly in these crisis time periods, people listen to false prophets. Now, I want you to think about what's the difference, the fundamental difference between a false prophet and a true prophet.
What the true prophet says actually happens.
Yes. Something more fundamental, Paul.
One is from God and one is not.
Where did they get their message from? If it's a false prophet, where did he get his message from? Yeah, dreamed it up. If it's a true prophet, he gets his message from God. The false prophets, guess where they really got their message? Market research. Right? What did they tell people? What they wanted to hear. What did they want to hear?
Everything's fine.
Everything's fine. Peace, peace. Everything's good. And so they were popular, but they were no help at all. Any of you ever had to find a new doctor? Maybe not. Can you imagine the process? Your doctor, sometimes doctors just get old and retire. So you lose your doctor and you finally find a new one. What kind of a doctor do you want? You ask all your friends, do you know any doctors who always tell good news, who always tell the patients everything's okay? That's the kind of doctor I want. A doctor would make me feel good. Is that the kind of doctor you really want? Why not?
I want a doctor that tells the truth.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want a preacher that tells you everything you want to hear? A prophet who just makes you feel good? Or do you want one that tells you the truth? The ones that make you feel good, he says it's like whitewashing a wall. Okay, now think about it, like a block wall. It's got all these fault lines running through it. Looks like it's about to collapse. Got a wall over here a while back that collapsed. And not while we were here, but by the next year. It looked like it was about to, and by the next year it was gone. So, you know, now think about, you know what whitewash is? It's kind of like, except it's thinner. Now, so you whitewash the wall. How does it look?
Pretty.
Pretty. Better. Does it help the structural integrity of the wall to whitewash it? No. It's no stronger than it was. It's no less likely to fall. Even if you painted it, how much strength does paint add to a crumbling wall? Virtually nothing. Paint's not going to hold it together. It may look better. That's the false prophets. They make you feel better. They say nice, comforting things, but they don't make any better. The reality's no better. That's what Ezekiel's telling them. The fact is, he says, there's going to be a terrible storm come through and going to wipe out that wall, whitewash it all. So the false prophets were really a problem because the people liked what they said and listened to them. How many people today shop around for a preacher that tells them things they want to hear? Know anybody in a bad divorce remarried situation that God would condemn as adultery, going from church to church trying to find a church that will say it's okay or from preacher to preacher trying to find a preacher who will say it's okay? Does it really help to find a preacher who says it's okay? Does that change anything with God? You know, so we got to watch that. Sometimes we want to only listen to the things that make us feel good, not the things that are true. That's why the false prophets were so popular. Questions, comments about all that? Like I say, we're just hitting high points, but that's what we got time for. Chapter 14, the elders in exile come back to Ezekiel with some questions for the Lord, and God says, I'm not even going to answer them because they've got idols in their hearts. They've gotten rid of the physical idols, but they still had the idols in their hearts. God knows what's in your heart. If you've got an idol in your heart, he's not going to listen to you. You know, I remember one thing I forgot to say. I'm going to go back to this. I'll end with this point, perhaps. So, this is because this is an important point. So, you had the idol of jealousy in the temple. And that was just a real outrage. Where's the temple of God today?
Our hearts.
Our hearts. We're the temple. So let me give you this illustration. Some of you heard me say this before, but a lot of you haven't heard me before. I was studying, working with a 22-year-old several years ago. He was a Christian. He was really messed up. And he was telling me this, very sad, very grief-stricken over how bad off he was. So he was confessing to me. But he said, not long before, you know how a lot of churches have a Bible study on Sunday morning and then they have like 10 minutes and then they have a worship service? He was in the church pew between Bible study and worship service. And he was so messed up that he caught himself realizing he was looking at pornography on his phone in the church pew between Bible study and services. Would you ever do that? He was supposed to help serve the Lord's Supper that morning. He was so disgusted by what he'd done that he gave his phone to one of the deacons. You would never do that, would you? But where's the temple of God? When we do, can you imagine going to the Holy of Holies with your girlfriend and making out right there in the presence of God? You wouldn't do that, would you? But where is God's presence? You know, if we thought about our lives, our bodies, as being God's presence, in God's presence, that's where God lives, are we driving him out because we're doing stuff that he just can't stand? Is it really that much different than your wife having a big portrait of her lover? There's a lot of other applications of that, too. But guys, I mean, think about this. Several of you have never been to this camp before. A lot of you guys have, but several of you haven't. Either way, I want you to think about how important it is for us to fundamentally change. This week needs to be more than just it was a fun week or it was an encouraging week. It needs to be a week where we come clean and where we really make serious changes. We need to think through, where are we at, what do we need? I'd say talk to somebody this week that you think you can trust, that'll help you, that'll help hold you accountable. And let's start working through whatever we need to make changes in to where we can really leave here stronger and ready to implement a plan that will keep us stronger and make us able to help other people. So I wanted to get that in. Chapter 14, remind me, if I need to be reminded, that we still need to talk about Noah, Daniel, and Job. That's where we'll end, at the middle of chapter 14. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to the singing. It'll be singing BC Lunch DEF.